Hello everybody, welcome to the Wild Ginger Running YouTube channel live broadcast. Today, I'm delighted to be here with Damien Hall, who had a absolutely cracking attempt at his first Barclay Marathons. Oh, I am using a microphone, by the way, so if you can't hear me, then do let me know on the live chat immediately and I'll just start it all over again. So now, hi Damien, welcome to the broadcast today.
Hi.
Awesome. So Damien speaks so often here on Wild Ginger Running that I've had to give him his own Damien Hall playlist. So there's a link in the film description below or in the show notes below if you're watching this on the podcast version. He just keeps doing these really balmy things and we have to keep talking to him to check that he's not gone totally bonkers yet. So have you gone totally bonkers yet, Damien?
Are you sure you just haven't run out of good guests and you need a filler? And you know I'll say yes because, you know, it's just chatting about running.
So, yes, well, for anyone who it is the first time that they've heard of Damo before, he is an outdoor journalist turned trail running journalist turned ultra running coach and climate ambassador, and he has held records on the Southwest Coast Path and the Pennine Way, and this year he completed an impressive 4 laps and got onto lap 5 of the Barclay Marathons before he conked out on lap 5, possibly due to not drinking enough tea. We'll let him explain, because I'm sure that was probably it, wasn't it, Damo?
I wish it was that straightforward. it turns out John Kelly kindly pointed out to me that only 17 people have ever finished the Barclay Marathons since it started in 1986. But only 19 people have ever started a fifth loop. So that means there are two of us in the world who have started a fifth loop and not finished it either then or at a subsequent time. And that's being me and the Canadian runner, Gary Robbins. So I'm both sort of thrilled to be in a pretty exclusive group, but also, yeah, a bit pretty frustrated by that. So... I had an amazing experience there. I feel very lucky because not many people can do the Barclay, not just because it's quite secretive, although there's good reasons for that I can go into if you like, but they can only take 40 people each time, partly the size of the campground and how many people the park will let on the trails, because it's quite a sensitive area. So it has to be a bit exclusive, unfortunately. So, I feel very lucky to get the opportunity. We had brilliant weather, actually. I mean, it was very cold at night. So it was probably past, minus 10 or so on one of the nights. But actually, that keeps the ground hard. And if you've got enough kit, you should be all right. And we didn't have, there was no rain at all. And the big fear at Barclay is fog, you know, thick fog coming down and then you just can't see a thing. So the weather was great.
Yeah.
The start time was quite nice. It was
8:45.
4 to 10 in the morning or something. In theory you get a full night's sleep, but I don't know if anyone slept that well. And then also he does tweak the course every year a little bit, and there hadn't been a finisher since 2017. So I hesitate to say it made it easier, but you got to think like he made one change to the course as far as I could tell that removed maybe only a 10 minute thing, but if you think it's 5 loops times 10 minutes, all right, somewhere anti-clockwise. But that might be a 40 minute difference. So that could be the difference between finishing and not those small tweaks that he makes.
Yeah.
So it was a good year.
It was a good year. Finishes.
So it was a good opportunity. So part of me is, you know, reasonably proud to have done 4 loops and started a fifth, but part of me is very frustrated that basically, 2 nights without sleep and I started on a loop a final loop anti-clockwise. I'd just come in clockwise. And that last book had been pretty straightforward, one of the easiest books to find.
Yeah.
But somehow going back the other direction, I guess mostly sleep deprivation and possibly you're basically in, they call them capstones. It's basically a lot of rocks, lots of high rocks. And I got, I suppose, confused amongst them or ended up at the wrong point and just couldn't find that blasted final book. or first book of that loop.
From that angle, it must have been completely different to, you think you know it coming from one angle or with someone else.
And then the other way, it seemed so straightforward that I almost didn't give it any thought of finding it again. And I went, but here's the odd thing, I went past all the rocks and went back out on the trail kind of the other way and tried to come in the way I had come, which I thought I was doing, but now you're sort of thinking, was it, or was that a different way? But that's, you know, that's the Barclay, that's, it's playing with you all the time. It's trying to sort of, it's trying to challenge you a lot more mentally than a normal ultra marathon, I suppose. And this time, I wasn't quite up to it, but I had a great adventure.
And I've just had a live question come in from Tadeusz Cantwell, and he says, does Damien think the current course is around the human limit in the five laps that's allowed?
I think it probably is close. So what I've learned is, listening to other people like John Kelly and so on talk about the Barclay, and there's two or three books out now that that reveal reveal more about Laz and things like that. You know, he's not trying to make something that's impossible. He's trying to make something that's just possible.
Yes.
So there's no point, you know, there's no point in making something that no one can finish.
Yeah.
But he tweaks it, and the weather comes into it, and how many loops you're going to do in the night, or whether you're going clockwise. So there's all these little tweaks. So it's just possible. And three people did finish this year. So it proved this year it was possible.
So he'll make it harder next year, which will be bad if you want to go back.
Yeah. That's part of the frustration of thinking, well, that year, this year was a great chance, although it was my first year. So
has anyone ever completed it the first time they've ever done it? Because that does sound impossible.
Yes. I think at least two people have, but it is pretty rare. I mean, John Kelly's had six goes, for example, for two finishes. And I was there. I was very lucky to have a brilliant crew. Guy called Jody, a Canadian guy, and he'd had five goes. A lot depends on the weather. And it's a really changeable time of year there. It's fascinating, actually. When I arrived in Tennessee, it was like well in the 20s, but by race day it was zero, basically.
Wow.
So at that time of year, it's jumping from like 20-25 degrees to zero minus.
Really changeable.
Yeah, the other year, I forget which year, but when Nicky Spinks did it the first time, and Ian Keith and James Elson, they had that dramatic change during the race. We didn't get that during the race. We knew it'd be cold and clear, or at least hoped the forecast was true. But those guys got it during the race, which is, that really messed people up there. So the weather's huge. But that's what makes it fascinating. It's this big puzzle.
Just on the edge of
possibility. So,
And I thought it was interesting the way you wrote, because you've written, if you go on Damien's Instagram, you can click all these links to various different things, and you've written a really nice report, like lap by lap, which is really interesting. I just thought it was really interesting how you got to the end and you said that you weren't physically incapable or too sleep deprived to go on, but it was like the frustration of like finding the books and the kind of the navigation aspect that was really the challenging thing for you personally.
Yeah,
that's kind of good, isn't it? Because you can learn that, like you can.
Yeah.
Or can you?
Well, I hope I can. I was really pleased with the fact that kind of physically I felt I was up to doing five loops, and mentally I wanted to go on, like I had that motivation.
Yeah.
When you know, after that amount of time, sometimes you don't, or sometimes you're broken.
Yeah.
But it was like almost a cerebral failure, I feel like. Well, partly a struggle to manage sleep deprivation, although that's an ongoing, like I'm reasonably experienced now at going through two nights, and that's where things start to unravel after two nights. But I've done that quite a few times. Sometimes it's gone really well, sometimes it's been more of a struggle. But the thing with the Barclay is that constant navigation, so the mental fatigue is huge, and it's quicker. So most trail races, the Spine is the classic example, I'm out there for longer, but you're following, all right, it's not a marked course as such, but you get a GPX, and you can mentally switch off quite a lot and just run. But at the Barclay, no, you're constantly trying to think, I'm on this bearing, is it that tree, is it that rock, is it that, so the mental alertness is huge, and that got the better of me ultimately.
I wonder how you would practice for that in the UK. Like, there's nothing really like the Barclays. Maybe you should set up like your April Fools post on Instagram about the Barclays coming to the UK. Maybe you should actually set up a sort of a Barclays practice race in the UK, even if it's just for you and Jasmine and Nikki and Tom.
I must admit that I felt bad after that Barclays April Fool's. It was Innovate's idea. For those who don't know, yeah, they sort of said, hey, we're bringing the Barclays to the UK. And hopefully as you read down the story, you began to realise maybe that wasn't true. But of course, several people said, oh, that would be amazing. I wish you were. And I suddenly felt bad because, of course, yeah.
You should. Like, it sounds like a really good idea. Like, I was just running around my local quarry this morning thinking, hang on a minute, this looks like the Barclays here. I could get everyone to go through the stinging nettles.
Well, there is. Yeah, that would be the equivalent of the briars, wouldn't it? Would be our stingers.
Yeah, in May or something. They're really high at the moment. They're like as high as a human.
And they can sting you. I mean, they can be more painful than saw briars, I think, at times. There have been times I've laid in bed at night not being able to sleep from stinging it. It's been pointed out to me that there is a Barclay Marathons here.
It's
in the Cotswolds, not too far from where I live.
Oh, okay.
There's a place called Barclay.
Oh.
So someone has created a 100-mile race from Barclay. It is loops as well, actually. So there is a Barclay Marathons, a Barclay Marathons here. Technically, it's not as, I don't think, I can't remember if there are books involved. But yeah, I believe New Zealand and maybe France have very similar formats. So it's not impossible to kind of practice it, but nothing's quite like
the real thing. Yeah. Mm. Because Kingsley says here, how were the brambles? Are they as sharp as people make out? But it seems no, if stinging nettles are worse.
I think I had a lucky year in that respect as well. So the place apparently where they are the worst is Rackjaw. And that is the only place on the course that can be photographed and people can come and spectate. But sometimes it does get mowed, I think, once a year. And it had just been mowed. So we were quite lucky there. I did get scratched elsewhere on the course, but it seemed more on my thighs than on my calf. So I didn't get the true kind of lacerating Barclay experience, which I was okay with. But yeah, they didn't seem nearly as bad as anticipated, I suppose, or as, you know, the hype. It's a bit like Marathon des Sables, where you see a few photos of bloody feet, bloody toes, and you think, well, everyone's feet are going to end up like that. And of course they don't. That's why that photo is so kind of, photos are shared around. So yeah, they weren't nearly as bad as I thought they might be.
Yeah. And apart from just basically wanting to follow John Kelly in everything that he does, when did you personally become interested in the Barclays yourself?
I should refute that claim, that comment. Although, yeah, John's a good friend and, greatly admire him. Although, yeah, I would claim I always intended to run down the Pennine Way at a record attempt, but I didn't quite have the courage until I knew he was going. And then I did think, well, if he's going, this was in the lockdown year, then I'll give it a go as well. But what was the question exactly? When did I think about it?
Yeah, what made you become interested in Barclays? Because obviously Jasmine did the previous year, and now it's and Nikki as well, and now it's you, and then Tom and James Elson's given it a go. So it seems like more and more Brits are sort of popping over to give it a go.
Yeah, I think really, ever since I first heard about it, it interested me, which would have been back in maybe even sort of 2013. It was before the film came out. Anyway, I got a good friend, local runner, Alex Copping, who filled my head full of bad ideas early on. And I remember, I think we had a discussion along the lines of, I don't know, what's the toughest race or, you know.
Yeah.
And then and I remember him saying, well, there's this one in America in the woods where, you know, you go around in loops and there are books. And it, of course, like most people, you remember thinking that's insane. But then, of course, that's insane. I would never do it. And then, of course, that percolates, you know, much like when I first heard about the spine race. You just think that's impossible. You couldn't
do
it.
Who does that?
And it just percolates. So for quite a long time, I was interested. And then it became the most common question I would ever get in interviews as well.
Yeah.
So it was almost like. And Jasmine said kind of the same, like it almost gets annoying. It's almost like, all right, then I'll go and do it. You'll want, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, some things have held me back, I suppose, partly. It's difficult to get into. And I think it's all right for me to say, like, I was on the wait list for 2 years. Like, they don't necessarily, if you're Jasmine Paris or John Kelly, you can get, you know, you can breeze in. But I'm not of their standard, so I had to be patient.
I think you are now, Damo. Now that you've done four on your first go.
It took a while, and then I suppose, there was part of me, if I'm honest, I do enjoy racing, you know, racing other people. And the Barclay never sounded like a race against other people. It doesn't feel that way either. Mm. But actually now, I don't know, the challenge is it's such a unique puzzle. Yeah. That, yeah,
it's I'm like glad. It's a challenge against yourself, isn't it? It's like, yeah, much more so, definitely. Can everything go perfectly on that day or a few days? And so training wise, I know you are an ultra coach yourself. And if you do want to book Damien, then... that or get his advice, then he's got a whole website and Instagram. Follow you there. I'll put all the links in the film description below. So yeah, how did you train? And I specifically, because I know you've got two quite young kids, not like super young like mine, but you've got two kids, a wife, and how did you fit that in all around your family and your work?
Well, the sort of interesting puzzle for me there was that I'd just done the spine race in mid January, and this was mid March. So it was more, the priority was getting recovered from the spine race. So that was number. So like I'd be fit, you know, wouldn't be too much of a concern now. I'd have fitness, but would I be? I suppose it's not just it's not just injuries or angry feet. It's, you know, is your energy back? Are your hormones balanced again? Is your whole endocrine system sort of recovered? So that was the immediate priority. So actually training was very light for a few weeks. But for reasons I can't be entirely sure, yeah, recovery did seem pretty quick from the spine. I think it might have been that I was very happy with what happened there. So I think I was just happy.
Yeah.
You sleep better, and
congratulations.
Probably, thank you. Probably more so than when you're frustrated with a race, and so on. So yeah, recovery seemed pretty good. And then, so all we really did was, yeah, I did try and work on navigation. I did do a few sort of, yeah, local orienteering race and so on.
Did you go out in the dark? Because I know I read on your blog that you felt like the navigation was your sort of weakest point.
Yeah, that was always my biggest concern. You know, I'm used to being out a long time. I like that, and you know, I like going up and down big lumps. It's fine, but I always thought navigation would be, yeah, the thing that might let me down, and it pretty much was. But I did try and work on it. I went out with a friend one night in the woods who's expert ex-military expert navigator, and we sort of he sort of tested me and taught me some things. I did an orienteering race. I feel like that was the third thing I did. Oh yeah, you can. I mean, it's quite far removed from Barclay, but you can get there's some apps available actually that have digital courses that you can do quite locally. So I did a couple of those. Right, it's nothing like navigating in the woods in Tennessee, but it's still running with that sort of that alertness, that tension, that sort of, well, where am I, where do I go next? So I did at least three things to try and improve my navigation, and also to try and improve my confidence in my navigation, which may be just as important. And the other thing was, yeah, so there weren't epic miles, but what I did do is there's a lot of climb in Barclay. There's a lot of steep uphill hiking, unbelievable amounts. It's like double, it's double what UTMB is for 100 miles. So I probably only had 3 days out where I just tried to hike, power hike. I did have 2 good days in the Lake District and then 1 probably in the Brecon Beacons, if I remember. Just trying to hike up and down steep bits a lot. But yeah, so it was recovery, steep, yeah, lots of ascent, and then a bit of navigation practice, really.
And do you find that quite easy to fit in then? Because if you're an ultra coach, you're presumably preparing people's training plans whenever you like, so you can sort of work whenever you like. You're not tied to a 9-to-5 role.
Yeah, I'll be honest. Life's pretty good and pretty flexible with
life's
that. if I'm honest. So now that the kids are at school, it's I can work my training and my work around that. So it's I feel a lot luckier now. But yeah, when they were younger, I suppose I'd do quite a bit of run commuting, and I wasn't afraid to get up at 5 or 6 a.m. or even go out at 7 or 8 in the evening. Although that's maybe less beneficial sometimes if you're not going to sleep well, for example. But yeah, I was never afraid to get up early. But things are easier now. And also I need my sleep more now than young, as you may.
Oh yeah, definitely. And so you got into Barclays, that's fantastic. What was it like arriving at that campsite? Because you sort of said it was a bit like being in a film set. is that because you've just watched so many sort of films about Barclay beforehand?
Yeah, it's because it, so one of the unique things about Barclay is, yeah, there's only like three places really that you see footage or even photos from.
Yeah.
Kind of the campground and the Yellow Gate.
The famous Yellow Gate.
I would say the Fire Tower and Down Ratjaw, which is where nearly all the photos of the race are from, which mm-hmm. probably people identify. There's the power lines going down and then people, you know, hiking up. And the third one is probably the prison, which probably people have seen maybe in some of the films. So those three spots, when you get to them, just feel totally surreal. Like, really, like, pinch yourself. Like, am I really here? Like, the Yellow Gate is amazing because I got there before. I was meeting John for a run. And you just sort of, yeah, you drive into the campground and it's just suddenly there. It's not, I don't know, you almost expect it to be like UTMB with like a, you know, a road to follow to this massive arch. And it's not, it's just a little yellow gate.
Yeah. But yeah.
The rest of the year means nothing, you know. And I think most locals there do seem to know about the Barclay. But for most of the time, you know, it's just a gate. And then you get to, you know, the Yellow Gate. It's honestly like a pilgrimage or something. It's it just felt so surreal. You're almost nervous to touch it in case, you know, it's a religious artifact or something. So yeah, I was lucky to get there a bit early and have some days in the park a little bit, although I should point out you're not allowed to recce off trail, and most of the race is off trail, so you can't really recce much at all, but it still helps. So that was pretty amazing, and then you come back there a few days later and suddenly, you know, Laz's tent is there and the number plates, and yeah, it just feels so surreal. I think in my blog I said it felt like Christmas on a film set or something.
Yeah.
But it's also, I was meeting friends, you know, Ian Keith, Nikki Spinks, Jasmine Paris, Emma Stewart was there, John, so there were a load of familiar, you know, good friends, familiar faces, and yet you're in this surreal setting. So yeah, it just felt amazing. Feel very lucky to have
And how important is your friendship with the tea dodger John Kelly?
he was incredibly, incredibly helpful. Much more than he should have been, really. We've got a quite intriguing sort of friend foe thing going on.
It is quite funny watching the two of you on Instagram sort of battle it out, sort of semi insult each other, but all with a friendly nature.
We're very different characters as well, but we're passionate about some of the, you know, very passionate about some of the same things and get the same enjoyment from, or I think the same enjoyment or some similar type of enjoyment from doing the same things. He was so helpful. So yeah, he gave up time to sort of show me around, not just the park or the bits he was allowed to show me around, but also he was quite keen to show me sort of Southern cuisine. Maybe I'll keep some of my thoughts to myself, not offend our Southern American South viewers, which is probably a big proportion of your viewers.
We do have a question from Arlene. She wants to ask you, I was going to ask this later because it was about your recovery afterwards, she says actually, did he find any food that he liked there in the Tennessee area, or did he bring his own with him? So I think she's prepared for the worst.
Well, yeah, I'm going to do a blog about this soon because, yeah, I've sort of went full annoying vegan sort of about 2.5 years ago now. But what I have found is if you're doing a race abroad, it's harder because the shops don't have the same things you're used to getting. And sometimes it's stuff you don't anticipate. Like in America, I should have known this, but you can't buy pickle. So I love cheese and pickle, cheese and pickle. And they don't really have pickle. They have something called like sweet relish, which is kind of sugary onions.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, that was, I did buy a couple of different of their relishes and it wasn't really, you can buy pickles.
Yes. You have to make your own, like chop it all up and get the vinegar.
I hadn't allotted a time window for that. I left that a bit late. So that coupled with John sort of being keen to show me, you know, Southern cuisine, I did sort of relax my vegan ethics for a little. I mean, I didn't have any meat or anything, but yeah, he took me to somewhere called Sonic, which is a drive-in takeaway. Although we sat there and there wasn't much on the menu I could eat, but I thought, well, there were these cinnamon rolls, basically. And I think they must have had a little bit of butter or something in, you know, not the end of the world. But, you know, normally I'd try and avoid them, but I didn't want to, I didn't want to offend him too much by sitting there and just having chips. I got these and they were just delicious. And it just so happened Jody was with us, who was going to crew me. And he, without me knowing, he had clocked that I liked them. And then he bought me a load during the race.
Oh, how sweet.
So, and I wasn't going to,
You have to, like, you know, humans are meant to eat a wide variety of food sources, aren't they? And being vegan, you know, is 100% is amazing. But, you know, if you do 80% of the time, then that sounds brilliant too.
I think so. And my approach is now when it comes to a race, you've just got to be a bit more relaxed. Because also, I mean, my first ever real sort of DNF was at UTMB 2021. Mm-hmm. And part of that was I got underfueled, and part of it was because I don't want this to sound like I'm making excuses, but in retrospect, I can see I was trying to be so careful that was one reason. I could have done other things better, but I got really underfueled, and then your motivation goes. And part of it was me trying to be like, oh, I don't know if that's vegan, I won't take that.
Yeah.
And that was my first big race being vegan. So I'm just more relaxed now because to me, it's more important to
generally get the general gist of veganness.
But also, if I do well in a race or a challenge, I get interviewed and I can talk about the bigger issues, and then that's more important to me. Yeah. Anyway, that's more worthwhile, even if it involves some compromise. Those Sonic cinnamon rolls were pretty special.
Lovely. They sound good. They sound really nice. And is it very important to have a mohawk? I believe that you have a mohawk. And then did Jody have a mohawk, or was it somebody else who was crewing you who
it
had
was,
a mohawk?
It was, Jody did have a mohawk. He had a double mo. He had a mohawk and a proper moustache as well.
Ah, mo and a mo. Excellent.
So it is absolutely critical that, John Kelly's got his own hair thing going on. Maybe he'd do even better. I mean, I often tell him if he would actually drink real tea.
And have a mohawk.
But I mean, I think so. That said, I mean, he's finished Barclay twice. I never have. And he's quicker than me on the Pennaway. So maybe I should be taking advice from him.
Maybe actually he's more aerodynamic. Because, like, you've got the thing here and, like, maybe the aerodynamics is not working.
The problem is I don't have his hair options any longer, as you can probably tell from the shininess of my big
expanded
forehead.
I thought that you'd just shaved it off on those sides.
Bit of both, let's say. So I can't really I can't do what he can do with his hair, unfortunately.
Oh, well, most of the time the photos that I've seen on the Barclays, you're wearing a hat anyway, so it doesn't matter. Maybe you should get a hat with a mohawk on it.
Or just wear like a plastic Roman legionnaire sort of helmet. Yeah.
Yes.
Maybe
exactly
that's the one.
That is the way to go. And so I know you were a bit concerned because Jody didn't seem to understand how to make tea to start with for crewing you. That seems like quite a stressful event, really.
It was very stressful. And things like words like chuffed were quite confusing. Squash was quite confusing to him.
Yeah. Did he just serve you something that was squashed, like a Sonic like roll that was squashed?
No, it didn't. And thankfully, he is very sort of detail orientated. So he's asking lots of questions, but it did, you know, he was like squash. Yeah, he obviously thought of the vegetable when I was talking about liquid for my soft flask. And he was like, you want squash in your soft flask?
That's hilarious. Do they not have squash in America then? What do they call it? Cordial?
Really?
Cordial, maybe.
I think so, And that was I did say to John, what can I bring over from the UK that you miss? And it was jelly babies and double strength squash. So it is rarer over there.
Strange, isn't it? You'd think that we just have the same things.
Yeah, I say with the pickle, you just thought they'd have pickle and they didn't. So, luckily pants didn't become a problem. That's the obvious one, isn't it? But also, I started calling my bum bag a fanny pack just to try and confuse him less.
Blend in.
But he was absolutely amazing, actually, and very very thoughtful and very forgiving and very. It was amazing to have someone who already had done it, and then he was saying just the right things of, you know, what to look out for on the next loop and things like that.
Yeah.
But very considerate, and the tea was actually pretty good. I was quite very happily surprised.
Excellent. And shoes, did you get blisters at all? It sounds like you may not have, because you sound like you were raring to go for the fifth lap.
Yeah, no, I didn't. I just, I would say it is the sort of course and reading in advance, it seemed quite common that people get blisters. I think because you're going down hills a lot, steep downhill. And so there's, even if you do your shoes up well, there's going to be sort of the traction, the movement in your shoe, your foot and your shoe. But no, I didn't seem to get blisters. I did swap between two pairs of Mudclaws each loop.
Okay.
Maybe I stayed in them one loop, but I always swapped socks in case there was, just bits of dirt or something that's going to cause blisters too. So I swapped socks every loop. And then I think I swapped shoes almost every loop, just between two pairs. Mm. And there were, because it was fairly dry, well, yeah, people would laugh at this really, but like the amount we would do to try and avoid getting wet feet was fairly silly. So there's one place, actually, when you go under the prison, there's a tiny bit of a, so there's water under the prison. It's quite long, you're going to get wet feet. Luckily, it was quite low, and there's a little wall you can almost tiptoe across, a tiny wall, and all of us were sort of dancing on this little wall, and it must seem so stupid to people outside thinking, yeah, but you're out there 60 hours getting bashed up, and we're trying not to get our toes wet. And when you get to the end of that, normally you'd have to get wet feet, but you can climb up the wall out of the prison, which kind of feels like you're trying to escape prison, in a particular way. If you do that in a particular way, you can avoid getting wet feet. And we would spend, you know, that would be 2 or 3 minutes longer, but we would all, well, most of us were doing that to avoid wet feet, because over that time, yeah, wet feet usually leads to trouble.
Yeah, it could be race ending, yeah. And the other really difficult thing that seems to be a real thing with Barclays is the sleep deprivation as well. And I just thought it was really, really ingenious, this idea of you and John sleeping on a book so that you'd get woken up by the next runner. I thought that was genius. But then you didn't get very long, did you? Because the next runner came along fairly quickly in both times.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, to his credit, that was John's idea. It's always the second night where things start to get difficult. And we both knew we were getting sleepy enough that you know, caffeine and calories wasn't enough. And that some sort of power nap or dirt nap, I think he calls them, was a good idea. And we both, so that, obviously you're not allowed your normal watch and Laz gives you, I might have it here. Laz.
Oh, do you get to keep it?
Yes.
Oh, I thought he might have reused them for eco-friendliness and like that just gave
be,
them to
that would
the
be better,
person.
Wouldn't it? But
well, as long as you're going
like
to use
it. It's like a $10 watch, so the alarm doesn't work apparently, or we couldn't figure it out. So the fear was, you want 10 to 20 minutes is great, but any more than that, and people have fallen asleep for hours there, and then that's the race over, because it's the time, the cutoff's quite, I'm not used to doing, I've never done a race where I've been concerned with the cutoffs, but here it's constantly on your mind. Oversleeping could be the end of it. So
yeah.
So John's idea was, let's sleep on the book. I literally had it under my head. but the next runner was only maybe not even a minute behind us, so we'd barely, we didn't drop off, I don't think, and he woke us up, and then we didn't know how long the next runner might be. There might have been no other runners left. So the risk then. So we just got up and carried on. But then, an hour or two later, I was with the other guy, Albert. John had gone on ahead. And we were both feeling sleepy again. And we tried again. And the same thing happened.
Yeah.
Aurelien, the French guy who finished, he caught us up a minute or two later and sort of woke us up. It's a great idea in theory, but didn't quite work for us.
I think Innovate need to invent something, don't they? They need to invent something at the end of your shoe that buzzes. Like you could set a 20-minute buzz timer on it, or a little 30-minute buzz timer. Maybe
that would be helpful.
That would be handy, wouldn't it? Yeah. Or just if you took, like, my mum's got a little cooking timer and it just beeps. It's like this big. It's very small.
At the moment, we're not allowed any electrical items.
You're not, okay.
Other than the watch he gives us. This is one of the rules that has changed. In the past, you were, say, allowed a music device, I believe. But so all of these rules, they get harder and harder. All these little rules change.
Okay.
I wonder what you could do then.
Like, maybe you could have an egg timer, but then there's no noise really, is there? I'll try and think of something for next year for you. That's something mechanical. I thought it was funny, I spoke to Jasmine as well, and she said that she found you on the path as well. And she stepped over you and she was like, hi, Damien, what are you doing on the path? And then you apparently woke up and you were like, are you okay, to her? She was like, you're asleep on a path in the middle of nowhere. That sounded like a funny moment.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. So I suppose when I, on that, third morning, when I'd looked for the book for an hour, and what I'd realised was, I didn't really have time, even if I found the book now, the timing was really tight to get round. And I'd been told at camp that, like, he didn't want anyone out past the cutoffs, if you know what I mean. He'd rather you came back to camp than, I imagine that's a safety thing, so I couldn't find the book. So to me, there wasn't any point in going on because it won't count if you haven't got the page. And then I was like, well, I've got 10 hours left. That's not, you know, that's not going to be enough. So I just kind of thought, well, there's nothing for it but to go back to camp. I'm done. I failed. But as soon as the adrenaline had worn off of you're not racing anymore, you're not, you know, it's all over. Yeah, I felt very, very sleepy. So I'd only got maybe 20 or 30 minutes down the mountain on these trails. But there's no one around, but it's a beautiful day, warm, sunny. And I just thought, well, I feel knackered now. I'll just have a sleep, you know. So I kind of slept across the trail. I'd seen no one on those trails for hours. So
you could have had 10 hours there.
Yeah.
If Jasmine hadn't found the book. could have been there for 10 hours and then done a sprint finish.
But I don't know. I think this time I did have a good 10 or 20 or maybe even 30 minutes. I'm not sure. But suddenly there was another runner. And I was like, it's Jasmine. Oh, wow. Like, you know, as far as I was concerned, she was still in the race. I hadn't, and she was coming in to finish her loop, although it was over time, I think. So it was a strange moment me and Jasmine are friends. And I coach her, and we'd even shared an Airbnb beforehand with her husband as well, Conrad. So it was a strange moment being so far from home, but, you know, that someone there you know very well. And I joined her for the run down, and we were sort of sharing, you know, we both had some satisfaction, but some frustration too. Of course, one of my next questions was, you know, did you find the book back up there? And she's like, yep.
You're like, oh, imagine if she'd been there earlier, like at the same time, like just as you'd got there.
Well,
Yeah,
I did try a power nap back up at the rocks. I thought, I added caffeine and calories, and then I thought, well, I need a power nap. I'm not thinking that well. I need a power nap, and I tried to sleep on the trail, but by that stage, I was having almost audio hallucinations. I kept hearing people talking, and I did actually think it was her chatting to another runner as they came. So I kept waking up, basically not really falling off to sleep. But thinking, oh, who's coming? Who's coming? So I had tried that. Maybe I should have just stayed there.
Who knows? And I should have asked you this question earlier. It was just like on my list now, but we did cover a little bit of food. But Christian Poulton, one of my patrons, he said, how did Damien find being vegan, which we've sort of covered. So he said, were there enough food choices for him at the aid station, or did he have to be so totally self-reliant? But I think you have to be totally self-reliant at Barclays. There is no aid station. There's some water, isn't there, that may or may not be frozen. but you have to be self-sufficient, don't you? So what sort of food did you take as a vegan?
They offer you no food. There was definitely some porridge it was fine to have oat milk. Oatly oat milk was in the supermarket in town. So yeah, had some porridge. I cooked a load of vegetable pasta. I think Jasmine was having some of that as well. What else did I have? So yeah, whenever I came back to camp, the idea is try and get as much real food in as possible. You might only be there 10 minutes. You're hopefully just eating and eating. Definitely some bananas, a variety of bars, both from home and one or two from over there.
Do you make your own bars, or do you use supernatural fuel, do you?
No, it's quite easy to find. At least in Britain, vegan bars are quite findable. For example, Velaforte, they do sponsor me, but I genuinely find their bars really tasty.
I really like their bars too.
Yeah, they're really nice. Dates and nuts, and often a bit of ginger or something to give it a little bit of spicy flavour.
Always approve of a ginger thing.
What else did I have? When I'd come back to camp, it was about getting some, you know, some warm, ideally warm, real food in. I feel like there was one other thing, but there was definitely porridge and pasta.
The cinnamon buns, that's probably another
one. Yes, I had them, although technically not vegan. But what else did I have? Oh, boiled potatoes, salted. Again, sort of shared them with Jasmine. It was, we cooked them the night before. I think she had some pizza, but she's not sort of totally vegan, although she doesn't have much. What else did I have? And then for both the spine and this, the thing I like when I'm on the trail a lot is just bagels, hummus bagels with usually something else. Like, I suppose that's what I want the pickle for. Or what did I have this time? I think
vegan
they had some
cheese.
Pickles.
I think you had vegan cheese in it, you said, in your blog thing.
Yes. I'm trying to think. Yeah, no, I must have found vegan cheese over there then. So obviously that's quite easy to find in Britain. I think I did find some over there, if I remember. So yeah, bagels, hummus bagels, basically, go down really well.
Yeah. Yeah. So there was good food there. Awesome.
Yeah.
The food. Oh yes. So we've covered the food. How did it feel just crossing that yellow gate the final time with were you with Jasmine at that point? How did it feel? Was it a mixture of sort of like yay and oh at the same time?
Yeah. I think as I was getting there, really, it was the disappointment was the bigger feeling. Because it was just such a lovely day, and I'd left camp, I suppose, by now, two or three, something like 3 hours maybe earlier, full of optimism. And like, it was about, I was leaving camp at, must have been 8 or 9 in the morning, sunny day. You know, my friends, it felt like my friends were there. You know, Nikki Spinks was there, and Jodie had been super encouraging. And it just felt, everything felt possible. And and then I was returning there sort of two to three hours later. People weren't expecting, you know, they weren't expecting me to come in, you know. So I almost wanted to sheepishly sort of tiptoe up to the gate and hope no one really saw.
But then they played the blooming bugle. Was it quite emotional then when the bugle was played? Because it's quite an emotional song, that Taps, isn't it? I find it quite emotional.
Yeah, that is the equivalent of, that is their kind of military, I've forgotten the name of the bugle that we play here on Remembrance Sunday, but I think that's their equivalent sort of thing to remember, you know, remember the fallen. So it is a to them especially, it is. And usually they will put their hand on their heart and so on.
Oh, yeah.
So it does mean a lot to them. So, yeah, I sort of tiptoed up to the gate. Unfortunately, people did see me. and then I explained to Laz and one of his assistants that, like, I'd brought back a stone and a leaf to prove I'd been there. I knew that was silly. But that
and you left biscuits there, didn't you? You left biscuits by the book to prove that you'd been there. That was funny as well.
It's no greater proof. It's no greater proof than a few biscuit crumbs. partly that was the state of my mind at the time. Partly I sort of knew that was silly, but kind of wanted to do it anyway. Got back to the gate, had a chat to them, and then they played Taps, which in some way feels oddly rewarding though, because it's one of those almost inevitable Barclay experiences, and it means you've been at Barclay, you know. So it felt both rewarding and disappointing at the same time, which is kind of strange.
And that just leads me to say, do you want to go back? Arlene wants to know if you want to go back. Bobby Cullen wants to know if you want to go back. Is it something that you want to do again? Oh no, we've lost Damien at that crucial point. Let's try and get him back. We've lost him. Right, let's just get Skype. Skype, here we go. Let's call him back. Oh dear. Let's call Damien back, because we were just about to find out if he'll go back to the Barclay Marathons. Oh no, he's not online. That's a shame. Yep, Severine's saying the suspense is real. It really is real. I think he does want to go back, so I've just... But I can't confirm. Ah, here he is. Welcome back. Hello.
Hello.
That was a really suspenseful moment there. We just literally asked you if you wanted to go back, and it just went.
um, Yes, yeah. On one hand, I'd love to try again. Just partly because, yeah, I don't feel like I suppose gave my best effort there.
Oh no, he's gone again. I wonder. I don't think it's my signal.
I'm very sorry. I think it's a problem this end. I'm not sure.
Hello. Yeah, I think it might be. I've got like full bars. But yeah, we're nearly done anyway. It's fine. We'll just keep calling you back. We're just talking about how you'll go back and uh-oh, it might be harder.
Yeah, I suppose I feel like I didn't give my best performance and now I've had a good recce. Like it won't be easy, but I now more fully understand what it is and can remember some of the book locations and stuff for the moment anyway. And I know I really need to work on my navigation, for example. I mean, the thing I hesitate over is, I suppose, yeah, the emissions from a flight is something I haven't, I've only done one flight in 4 years. So I've really tried to sort of change that part of my footprint from being an athlete, I suppose. So I made a little list a while ago of kind of what are the really important to me adventures left that I would consider flying for, and sort of scrubbed a lot of other races off the list. And then I've had some amazing invitations in the last few years that would have involved a flight, and I just kind of thought, no, it doesn't matter enough to me, but this was absolutely top. So I think I am prepared to give it one more go. Someone did ask me, what about, would you go back the following year, a third time in a row? And that is all on the, I don't actually know if I can get in again. That's beyond my control. But that's really tricky. I don't feel comfortable at the moment anyway, the idea of sort of going back 3, 4, 5 years in terms of the emissions. And I have looked into all the boating options it's just, if I didn't have kids, I would do it that way. But you're away a long, long time, and it doesn't just, I don't want them to forget who I am.
Is it 3 weeks on the boat?
I think the trip would end up more like 4 weeks, because even the boat doesn't go to, or one of the options I was looking at, it doesn't get you to the right bit of America. So you've still got to all the way, travel all the way down America. So yeah, along those lines, it was several weeks, so that's the thing that would stop me going, but yeah. I'd like to try one more time, even though I feel uneasy about the footprint.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, the whole footprint business, because I've seen your Instagram, and I know that you do a lot about the climate, and that's the first thing that people absolutely jump on you for. And Bobby is asking, not in a horrible way, Bobby Cullen, he's asking, how do you justify the travel and the associated carbon footprint for such a race? Because I know that, like, obviously people aren't going to jump down your throat if you choose something with plastic packaging in the supermarket, but people see the flight and they see the huge emissions and they go, that person's telling us to do this or broadcasting about this, and then he takes a flight. Oh my god. And it just seems to me that is the one thing that people can't really wrap their heads around. And I didn't know if you had, I've read all the stuff, I understand the opinions, and it's not all black and white, but is there sort of a nutshell way that you can explain it to people?
Yeah, I mean, I could chat about this for an hour or so. If you're trying to keep it succinct, I guess there are a few things. I suppose one is, my footprint as an athlete has massively reduced, because I used to do on average 3 flights a year to races. Now, that obviously, now I'm much more aware that that's pretty bad, and I couldn't justify that to myself. So I've reduced that massively. 3 years of no flights, one flight for running in 4 years. That's a huge improvement. Mm. The next one is this sort of mantra of progress, not perfection. Like, even if I didn't, none of us can be perfect. Yeah, we can. A very few people have given up flying, which is incredible. I've given up, I suppose, almost all flying, except in very exceptional circumstances where I think that's a really, and this is, without getting the violins out, this is how I support my family, through running. Very exceptional circumstances. I think I've got one or maybe two other things I'd fly for and I would hope to, I certainly wouldn't fly more than once in a year, but I've done one flight in 4 years. That's probably better than most people, and a huge improvement from where I was.
Yeah.
Then the other side of this is that kind of personal footprint versus system change. And how important is your personal footprint anyway? Now this gets debated like massively in sustainability circles and among scientists and so on. And I've read numerous books on it. And what I tried to sort of debate in my book as well. And to me, I know this sounds convenient, but to me, yeah, there are some low hanging fruit to reduce your own footprint. But to me, that's not the most important thing. Mm-hmm. It's pushing for system change. So if you're, you know, fastidiously washing your hummus pots up for recycling, but a coal mine opens up the road as is happening in Cumbria, that's far worse than whether you did your recycling or, I mean, it's a bit disingenuous of me to compare recycling to taking a flight, because a flight is significant. But what I mean is that personal footprint stuff isn't as important as the coal mine starting up down the road, because that's going to be epically worse than whether, your own footprint things. So I would say, I'm still there.
You're there.
I would say I personally I devote a lot of my time for that as well. I gave up 2 days recently to go and protest in London at the big one. You know, it was two days of my life where, you know, I don't directly get anything from that. I guess it helps my conscience a little bit and helps my anxiety about what's happening in the world. But I gave up 2 days to do that. I gave up numerous days to write this book that, so I suppose, won't make any money, but hopefully will spread a message. And then the Green Runners stuff as well. I feel like there's this other, so to me, that's all nudging for system change. Or there's this other really interesting concept of the carbon shadow. So that, and this is explained brilliantly. I think there's a link through on one of my blogs to this.
Yeah, there is.
The great example there is, like, there's two neighbors. One of them walks to work and walks home. One of them flies once a month. Like, one of them has a far better carbon footprint than the other, clearly. But what if the person who walks to work is walking to work for big oil, work in fossil fuels, and the person who flies is a climate scientist and they're flying to important conferences to exchange information and spread awareness. Now, clearly, that person has a far better shadow. And the other thing to remember is that BP came up with the idea of individual footprints.
Yeah,
now, at the same time,
interesting.
It was the PR firm who were paid to advise them, and it was over a decade ago.
Yeah,
so,
and I thought that was really interesting, because that puts the onus on us to change and make those changes. And whilst we're obsessed with washing our hummus pots, we don't have time then to do the activism in a group scale that BP obviously doesn't want us to do. I just thought that was really interesting, because I feel like amazing guilt of all the things that I don't do. You know, every time I go to get Finley in the car from nursery because it's raining really badly and I don't want to go on my bike, which isn't often, but, you know, it happens. I feel really guilty just from that one little car journey. And then actually, if you think of BP and all the fossil fuel companies and Shell and everybody and what they're doing, my guilt could be much better directed at them and emailing them, or doing that thing where you went and stuck your finger up at them and put it on Instagram. Like, I should have been doing all that rather than just agonizing over my hummus pot. So I thought that was really interesting to know, because I didn't know that, and I don't think a lot of people do know that.
Well, I'm strongly behind that approach. At the same time, of course, that's convenient because it lets me still fly occasionally. But I think it's unfair and unrealistic to expect, you know, if you care, then you mustn't fly ever again.
Yeah.
You mustn't eat dairy. You mustn't buy any new clothes. Like, we did discuss this when we formed the Green Runners. Like, are we trying to be like that? And then we're like, well, A, who? None of us are able to keep to all those three things. And then who's going to join us? Like, we're just going to be an eco-weirdo cult, you know.
You'd have to be a monk to exist like that. You'd have to be a monk, and then no one would know anything, because you wouldn't be telling anyone anything. You wouldn't be ever interviewed on the telly for doing an amazing thing. Yeah, it's just so hard, isn't it? Because I just see people jump on you on Instagram for the flying, and I just think it's such an easy thing for people to just go, bam, 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 we're not listening to him. But I just think it's so much more nuanced than that. And I just, I like to sort of, yeah, if I ever see people doing that, I always like to put a nice comment on there.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Claire.
Just because I just think it's an easy battering ram for people. And I wish there was an easy way to explain to them that the odd flight is, you know, while it's not ideal, it's kind of okay. You give some, you take some. Just by being alive, we're impacting on the planet. So we can't just all kill ourselves, can we?
No, well, thank you, Claire. And yeah, totally agree. And yeah, that guilt for existence, quite a few of us feel that, and it's just not fair. And we've inherited the system based on fossil fuels, and it's not our fault that, you know, for example, you know, electric vehicles, they're not perfect, but they're much better than fossil fuel vehicles. But most of us can't afford them at the moment. Like, and the government still subsidize fossil fuels massively ahead of other things. So they could be helping in so many ways, you know, transition more quickly to renewables, transition more quickly to EVs. But they're, you know, they help very little. And you know, that's the thing the scientists are saying. We need to get off fossil fuels urgently. No new exploration, especially in the North Sea and in the UK's case. That's what the scientists are screaming.
Yeah.
So to me, yeah, they're the more important things. I mean, I still do both, you know, like I do what I realistically can in a personal footprint thing. But I would just warn people against getting too obsessed with their own footprint and try and see what's happening in wider society. Classic things, big, I mean, the classic one is vote, you know, voting. We don't get to do that very much, but that's the big, probably the biggest thing we can do. But that's a bit unsatisfying because it only happens every few years. But it might be emailing Rumpy. There's if you join up with something like Greenpeace, you know, just register for their mailing emails. You know, they send you out an email when there's something relevant coming up. Imagine if 100 people were emailing an MP to say, hey, we care about this. You know, that stuff is gonna count towards something.
So stop washing your helmet parts and start emailing people.
I think so. Well, join the Green Runners at the least.
Yeah, join the Green Runners. We have got another climate related question from Andrew Knox, and he says, do you think the UTMB will start to open up more events in each country to reduce the need for people flying to events? Because, you know, those qualifying events to get those running stones, because he says previously it was quite easy to pick up the ITRA points before the new system came into play. And I know that they've been a bit under fire because if you want to get into UTMB, you've now got to, unless you get into a race in the UK, which there's only one, you have to fly to somewhere to get those points. So do you think, are you going to be campaigning them as well to change that?
Yeah, we've been discussing that. The Green Runners of sort of what to do action wise over the next few months, and that's definitely something that's being discussed. I think it's a real shame there's only one. I think that's it's rubbish, and I said that on Instagram within the last week. I think of kind of like I believe I've heard rumors. You know, they're hoping to start up another race here, but I don't know how long that takes, and if they're encouraging more people to fly, I mean, technically you could say, you know, the races in France, maybe that's accessible on public transport, but not for everyone. And often it's more expensive. So
twice
again,
the price. It's sometimes three or four times the price, actually. I looked into it as well.
I don't like what they're doing with the World Series at the moment, because it's encouraging more travel. And that's the most events, biggest slice of the footprint will be the spectator travel. So if it's flying, then it's massively elevated.
So not
a fan of what they're currently doing, if I'm honest.
Hopefully that will change. They're doing good things around female participation and pregnancy deferrals now, so that's one good step in the right direction. But they at least they're
only
listening.
Took about 5 years, didn't it?
Only took about 5 years. Well done, Sophie. But everyone's really appreciated the chat on the climate, so thanks for that. Severine says it's 7 days to New York by boat. She had to look at that for a group during the ash cloud some years back, so respect regarding voting with his feet. Today says, I have an idea that the individual footprint will backfire eventually by creating a new mindset that big companies will find it hard to go against. But he says maybe that's a bit too optimistic, but I think the tide is changing. I think the tide is slowly turning, hopefully. Bobby has been listening, so he says, thanks very much for your answers. Very good answers on a complex subject, he said. And Bobby does have one more question, and then I've just got some quick fire questions for you, and then we'll leave you to your day. He says, is the spine race record an objective after the win last year? And how about the summer record, which I think is now down to 70 hours? So how about that?
I'm definitely coming back in January. I just love...
You love that race, don't you? You must know it so well by now. Yeah.
So does Bobby, if I'm thinking about the right person. I think it's just a cracking adventure, you know? And part of that is the weather and the unknown, you know, what's the weather going to do? So I'm primarily... I'm not disinterested in the overall record, but it's a sort of nice to have. Like, I want to go there, have a great adventure, give my best possible performance. You know, if that can reach, you know, if that can, you know, get past Jasmine's record, great. But I'm not, not obsessing over beating her record. I don't know if I'm still.
Yeah.
Oh. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can still hear you. Yeah.
I don't know how much of that was heard. Sorry.
Oh yeah, no, you were fine. I could hear you the whole time.
Yeah.
Oh, and now I can't. He was preempting the Skype debacle. I think Shaznay says, quick fire question, any plans to try and get the FKT back for the Pennine Way? Yes, okay, we'll ask him that as well. We'll wait for Damo to come back. And then we'll just ask him the quickfire question. Maybe I won't ask him the quickfire questions. It says it's reconnecting. Let's just see if he rings back. We haven't got long to go. Sorry about this, everybody. I blame Damien. So, yeah, I think he will go and have a good time on the spine race. Let's try ringing him back now. I don't know if you can hear the Skype beeping. I think he's in his shed. So he needs to get a cable to his shed. Yep, oh well. Well, we've heard a lot of good things from Damien, so if he doesn't manage to ring back, then it'll still be a really good podcast and live broadcast. But just, he hopefully will just ring back in a second and we can just finish off the interview there. Talk amongst yourselves, everybody. I've got some quick fire questions for Damien, including flapjack or gels, beer or wine, Kindle or a real book, music on your long run or birdsong, classical art or modern art, camping or a holiday cottage, seaside run or a mountain run, or tea or tree. Yes, Shaznay999 says, he's always in his shed. I know he's always in his shed. He was in his shed last time and didn't have these problems. So I don't know, I hope it's not me having these, but I've got 4 bars of internet. Let's just try him one more time. Usually he rings back. Maybe just don't wanna, maybe just felt like an hour was enough for the interview. He might be emailing me. Here he is. Hello.
Hello, I'm so sorry.
You went into the vortex again.
I am sorry. Sorry, everyone.
It's okay. We haven't got long left. Sorry, we've kept you a little bit longer than I said. We've got a little question here from Shaznay999. Quickfire question. Any plans to try and get the FKT back for the Pennine Way from John Kelly? Hint, hint.
I would say I don't have immediate plans, but I haven't ruled it out. I won't try this year. I've got 2 more events, so that's probably enough. I guess I might just see next year how I'm feeling, really, like physically and almost mentally, you know, even if I can beat it, it'll be very close, and you've got to be ready to sort of, to use the cliche, I suppose, dig deep for, you know, three days and 2 nights. So it's yes, it's still a possibility to have a go anyway. No immediate plans.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Because he's back in the US now, so it'd be a good time to try and beat it, wouldn't it? Because he can't come back and take it from you again for a while.
I would, honestly, I think if I could, I think he would still come back and try again.
I think he probably would. Yeah. I've just got some quick fire questions before we leave you today, Damien. Flapjack or gels?
Flapjack.
Beer or wine?
Wine.
Kindle or a real book?
Real book.
Music on your run or birdsong?
Oh, podcasts.
Oh, a sideways answer. Classical art or modern art?
Real landscapes.
Oh, camping or a holiday cottage?
Camping.
Seaside run or mountain run?
Mountain.
Tea or tree?
Oh, gosh.
Tea spelt both ways.
Oh, yeah, tea, E-A, yeah, tea.
Tea.
You can't drink a tree.
That's their fabulous answers. Well, thank you so much, Damien. It was really, really awesome to chat to you this lunchtime. So congratulations again on being a pretty all right runner. And I hope you're training for the next event, the next record, the next anything that you're doing goes really, really well. Where will we see you next?
The next big one for me is Tour de Gion in September in the Italian Alps.
Jasmine's going there too.
Yeah, there'll be a few of us out there. It should be, especially the British female field should be really strong. Luckily that's fairly easy to get to on public transport. But yeah, that's my next big one. I may do a B race before that, but that's the big one. Thank you. And yeah, just so sorry I kept dropping out of the call. Sorry.
That's okay. You're good enough to wait for. It's been really lovely chatting to you. And follow Damien on Instagram. Have a look at his website. There's loads of resources there about the Green Runners and how to get into activism. I'm definitely going to get into some more activism and stop feeling so guilty about my own tiny, tiny carbon footprint. Not tiny, tiny carbon footprint, but the tiny effect that my carbon footprint has. I'm going to be looking more into it. So thank you very much for the interview. It's reinvigorated my climate anxiety. So I'm going to be doing more things and doing some more activism as well.
Oh, well, thank you, Claire.
No problems. It was lovely to chat to you today. And we will, Bobby just says, I think Damien's Wi-Fi is powered by composting.
That's the problem. Yeah.
Living the dream. Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Damien. It was great to chat to you, and we will we'll look out for your progress in Tour de Gion.
Cheers, folks. Thank you, Claire.
Bye.